Branch Incorporated and others versus William Warren Chapman III and others from Nueces County and the 13th Appellate District. Ridge Oil Company and Brian Woodward versus Wynn Investments from Young County and the 2nd Appellate District. And N. Ray, the Prudential Insurance Company of America and others, a petition for writ of mandamus. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between each argument and complete the arguments by noon. If you wish to purchase a tape, an audio tape of any of these arguments, you may do so for a nominal fee by contacting the clerk of the court. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in the first matter. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in King Ranch versus Chapman.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner can reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this case is an appeal by King Ranch Incorporated to reinstate a summary judgment in its favor opposed to a bill of review and trespass to tribe title action brought by the Chapmans. The purpose of which was to set aside an 1883 consent judgment and reclaim 7,500 acres of King Ranch based on fraud that supposedly occurred in 1881 and 1882. There are three broad issues before the court this morning. Is the bill of review barred by limitations? If not, is there evidence under the no evidence summary judgment standard to support the elements of the bill of review? And number three, did King Ranch's summary judgment proof establish adverse possession conclusively? Much like the dilemma that faced me in the Henry Schein case when I approached the podium, I don't know really where to begin. But yesterday I was on the streets of Temple, Texas, and ran into the revered legal icon in Texas, Jim Bomer. And he asked me where I was going, and I told him about this case. And he immediately said, "My goodness, doesn't the statute ever run?" And I thought that that was a clue that this was where I should begin, with the four-year statute of limitations. Under the legal injury rule, which is discussed thoroughly by this court in SV versus Arden, we have no difficulty in determining when the statute of limitations accrued for a bill of review. It accrued when the judgment under attack was entered. We have established as a matter of law that this claim was filed not only 4 years beyond that time, but actually 118 years beyond the time after the original judgment was entered. What was pleaded in defense of the statute of limitations was the discovery rule and fraudulent concealment. The Court of Appeals' discussion of this aspect of the case, which is about two sentences long, I think makes three very serious errors. The first is that the discovery rule applies to bills of review at all. The second is that evidence of the fraud element embedded within the bill of review standard is sufficient to operate as some form of tolling. And three, that it was King Ranch's burden to disprove conclusively of the doctrines that would either defer accrual or toll the statute of limitations. The latter holding is clearly wrong. Under the new summary judgment evidence standards, because the plaintiffs in this case would have borne the burden both to establish the applicability of the discovery rule as it applies and fraudulent concealment is on them at trial, it was their burden to raise the issue. I would say that it's an intriguing issue for the court as to whether or not discovery rule applies in this case, because clearly I think because bill of review is an attack upon a judgment which is of record, it is clearly not inherently undiscoverable. And the fraud element, at least a fraud element embedded within the elements of the bill of review, I think is also not objectively verifiable because it often resides within the minds of the participating parties. The question as to whether or not fraudulent concealment applies in this type of case is an intriguing one, because fraudulent concealment must be itself an independent tort and generally not related to the fraud, which would support the bill of review. So what you would have, in my judgment, is a fraud concealing a fraud, which is not shown in this case. But perhaps the court does not really need to get to that. The case can be disposed of on the bill of review aspect, I think simply under the no evidence summary judgment standard, on two grounds.
Mr. Hatchell, let me direct you in a different direction a little bit here. Put the statute of limitations argument to the side for now. Assume that's not an issue. What about the arguments that there were no ad litems for the minor children after Helen died, and that the probate court did not approve the 1883 judgment? Do those present significant problems to the viability of the judgment?
We think they do not, Your Honor, because, first of all, the probate records themselves are not necessarily shown to be complete. And there is a venerable rule that this court has established, establishing a presumption, which has not been rebutted in this case, as to the regularity of the probate records. This argument goes actually to an argument which is even, I think, aside from the bill of review, and that is that the judgment itself is void. There are several aspects of that, but the specific question you asked is answered by the presumption of regularity of probate records. There is also a contention, which may be embodied within your question, as to whether or not the executor of Mrs. Chapman had the authority to, I don't consider this a settlement of the case, but had the authority to enter into the agreed judgment. And clearly he did under old Article 1202. He had the authority to bring the action to recover property. The only time heirs would have to be joined under clearly under the statute and under this court's holding in East versus Dubin would be if Captain King had sought affirmative relief, which he did not do.
Yeah, and I've read Hope about that argument in your briefing. You don't consider the agreed judgment to be a settlement of the dispute?
I do not consider it to be an agreed settlement because by its decretal terms, it settled title in Helen Chapman as to one half of the interest which she was seeking. And then it operates as a sale of the other half that was in dispute.
If it were a settlement, then at least under recent common law in Texas, the minor children, if there was a potential dispute, would need to have ad litem representation, correct?
Your Honor, I do not think so because I think the statutes, this operates as a sale, I think. And so I think the statutes very clearly vested all of the, bear in mind at the time, now I guess you're talking about Helen's children and not the grandchildren, yes. And I think that they would not have to have had, because there's no evidence that Helen's children were minors at the time. They died in 1902 and 1907, I believe. So guardians ad litem for Helen's two children, in fact, one of which was, as I recall, was named as executor in the state. So it would not be required, I think. Have I answered Your Honor's question?
And to flesh out further, if you would, the fact that the probate court did not approve the settlement.
We do not think, Your Honor, that there is any evidence that the probate court did not.
You think the presumption, think the presumption covers
the
that
presumption
issue?
Of regularity, but number two, we also take the position that under the statutes, the executor very clearly, and I think that, as a matter of fact, I think you can look at the 1201 and 1202 passed together and look at the legislative history of that to see that those statutes were passed precisely to avoid the problem that Your Honor raised, so that the executor had authority under the statutes to do precisely what. Under the no evidence standard, the plaintiffs in this case had to prove that succeeding generations did not discover or no facts sufficient to raise inquiry into those into the fraud that they claim justifies their bill of review. In this case can be disposed of, I think, on simple grounds that there is no such evidence. The plaintiffs simply did not attempt, they made no attempt at all to show what the succeeding generations of Chapman heirs knew or did not know. But we can go farther than that because, as a matter of law, the evidence in this record establishes that the original participants and the heirs had notice of those facts that they now claim support the fraud which they believe that Captain King and Attorney Clayburgh engaged in. I'm not conceding that these facts are sufficient to show what they need to show, but if this is what they say raises the fraud, they had knowledge of it. They had suspicions about the existence of the original judgment to begin with. There are letters immediately after the 1883 judgment questioning why they could not, in contravention of Clayburgh's letter, why they could not prove their title. The account book, which the principal movement behind this present action claims made the fraud full-blown, in his own words, has been in the possession of the Chapman family for over 100 years. There is a letter evidence in the record showing that Chapman heirs knew that Major Chapman had, quote, bid off the property for himself at the time of the sale from the Lewis interest. And under HECI, I think this court would hold that the Chapman heirs also knew everything that they claim was defective, Your Honor. And that is that the Chapman heirs were not joined in the suit or served, that there was no approval or settlement, that the Lewis deed, even though admitted, was not recorded, and that Clayburgh had represented King in other matters. So I think that really puts the statute of limitations issue to rest. When you turn to the adverse possession issue in the case, what you find are two statutes, 16.027 and 16.028. The elements of which are quite simple. 16.027 requires simply that the claimant cultivate, use, or enjoy the property. 16.028 requires that the claimant hold in good faith under a recorded deed. The elements under 16.028 are, I think, particularly appropriate for this case because this is a statute of repose. No disability, Justice Wainwright, of any of the heirs, such as being minors and the like, would apply. The statute applies whether the deed, or in this case, the judgment, is void or voidable. It applies to any type of action, and as I say, no disability tolls it. In this case, what we have is evidence that the judgment itself in cause number 1279 operates as a deed. Alice King has conveyed the property by a duly recorded deed in 1934. That's established as a matter of law. And there have been no assertions of an adverse claim during the entire history of this property, dating from Captain King's pleadings in cause number 1279, dated to 1879. Insofar as the holding in good faith is concerned, that's not been a problem to this court because what the case is held simply is that one holds in good faith if he holds under a deed that's valid on its face and there is no knowledge of an adverse claim. And beginning in 1879, Captain King began pleading, and there's a title opinion in 1904, and there's an affidavit from a King Ranch attorney dated covering the time period from 1939. That there's never been an adverse claim to King Ranch property. We say, therefore, two doctrines completely dispose of this case, statute of limitations on the bill of review and adverse possession.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Craig Smith will now present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. I'm going to be using a PowerPoint presentation, and a beeping sound comes from the equipment. My name is Craig Smith, and I'm representing 21 people who have superior record title to a portion of the King Ranch. And the beginning point for this court's analysis, in my opinion, should be right here, which is the judgment. This judgment does not divest my client's predecessors of record title of this portion of the real property. And this is true for a number of reasons. First of all, this judgment right here very specifically purports to divest title out of the estate of Helen Chapman, which under Article 1202, which is right here, bottom part, it can't do without joining the heirs. This court squarely held in East v. Dugan that this type of a judgment requires the presence of heirs to be joined as parties. The reason why this law was passed in 1870, along with Article 1934, was to prevent collusive plundering of the estates of deceased persons, which is exactly what happened in this case. This is the statute that absolutely required going to a probate court as a potential alternative, if not an additional requirement. They had to get probate court permission before purporting to settle this case. And that's just the second defect, Your Honor. It goes on, it really gets better, because if you look at if you examine the will of Helen Chapman, you will see she appointed co-executors.
So are you saying that the judgment is void?
I'm saying the judgment is void, it's voidable, it's not final.
Do the article that you just, 1202 or this one, does it provide that in the absence of joining the heirs that the judgment is void? Or is it just erroneous?
Well, in East v. Dugan, this court squarely held that it was not binding. And the voidable dichotomy that Exxon has brought into the mix is really, it's a definitional issue, because there are multiple definitions for the word void or voidable. For example, if you are not a party or served with a judgment, does that make it void? Or does it make it voidable? So there's one set of voidness issues with respect to constitutional issues. There's a Texas common law definition of void voidable that looks at the face of the judgment, and also including the record, to determine whether the judge is void or voidable. And then in this particular case, what we have here is evidence extrinsic to the judgment. For example, the lack of power by Rankin under the probate code to settle the case. If Rankin actually lacks power or capacity to settle the case, does that make it void or voidable? That's really not clear. It depends on the definition that you adopt. If it's void or if it's voidable, if it's void, we have superior record title, and they have not conclusively proven adverse possession. If it's voidable, we have the opportunity under the Bill of Review to go in, set aside the judgment for extrinsic fraud, if we can prove it, and put the parties in the same position that they were in at the time this judgment was supposedly entered. That is the remedy that the Bill of Review grants. So, does that answer your question?
Yes, I think so. You're saying that the statute doesn't say it's void, but you want us to hold that. And my concern is there are all kinds of statutes that require certain things to be in judgments, which does not make the judgment void, that the parties who are participants have an appellate remedy, and so they've got to take that remedy, for example, in this case, from the 1883 judgment, which didn't occur.
This case was carefully designed by Clayburgh and King, our contention is, to negate appellate review. In fact, if you examine the fraud carefully, it appears specifically intended to negate all review by all of the persons who were built into the process to review this action. For example, let's start with the district judge in cause number 1279. Rankin and Clayburgh misrepresented Rankin's authority to that judge in cause number 1279. They filed a motion seeking to substitute Rankin as the party. And in that motion, they represented that Rankin was the executor of Helen's estate, which is not accurate. Rankin was a co-executor with Will Annexed. And that meant two things. He could not act without the co-executor. He could not act without an order of the probate court. And he could not act and had no power to act, Justice Jefferson. He lacked power to act under the statute because he did not get permission. So Brayton was taken out of the loop. The judge in the district court was taken out of the loop through that misrepresentation. The probate court was taken out of the loop. And the only two people who decided this were Claver, Rankin, and King. And for that reason, and since it's a consent judgment, there is supposedly going to be no appeal because, you know, there's nobody objecting to the entry of the judgment. So that is one of the key problems in this case. Now, the reason why I believe we have sufficient evidence of extrinsic fraud in this case, and it's concealed extrinsic fraud, it's not simply because of looking at the big picture, what happened, which I've described to you, but also let's look at the circumstances. What happened? Claiborne is King's lawyer. Claiborne is Helen's lawyer. Claiborne purports to settle this case. Claiborne is the one who ends up on the premises. For example, in 1904, Claiborne is the president of the Claiborne Town Improvement Company. He ends up with the property. And this is not a fee. I mean, whenever we see a lawyer who has a client and ends up with that client's property and it's not a fee, you know, that just sometimes we take a second look. A second look. That's not enough to say that's fraud. But that, you know, maybe the next step. Well, the next step here.
Claiborne Mary.
Alice Claiborne, Richard King's daughter.
And what year was that wedding?
That was in 1885.
Which might have something to do with being married.
Yes, Your Honor. And you see, we believe that cuts both ways and requires a jury to resolve this dispute because why is Claiborne doing what he's doing? Is he doing it because he and Richard King have committed fraud and they're attempting to launder the title to the Rincon through the Claiborne Town Improvement Company? Or is it doing it out of love and affection for Alice? The evidence in this case shows that Claiborne and King were involved in a conspiracy to defraud the remainder of their title. That title was conveyed to the remainder men in trust.
I'm reading the judgment here. Did the remainder men, did the estate get paid for the interest in this land? Or is your point that they didn't get paid for this interest in the land?
That issue was not litigated in the trial court.
But as I read the judgment, there was a transfer of title by agreement of the parties in exchange for King paying for the land. Is that an ambiguity in the judgment, or is the judgment clear about that?
No, that's what the judgment says. We dispute the legal effect of that judgment.
So are you arguing that the money that the estate received was insufficient at the time this money was paid for the value of the land?
Yes, we've disputed that in the trial court, but the parties in the summary judgment motions were precise on certain issues, and nobody got the economists out and argued that the value wasn't a fair exchange. We contend it was not a fair exchange, but that the summary judgment arguments did not revolve around that particular issue.
But is it necessary to your argument into this settlement agreement when you're talking about extrinsic fraud that occurs is it necessary to your argument that the hangman, that, let me start, is it not necessary to your argument that you have to establish that the exchange of money for the title to the land was grossly insufficient?
No.
Why? So merely the fact that there was a sale of property when the owner of the property says they didn't authorize the agent to do so, you say is sufficient to establish extrinsic fraud?
No. No. We have so much more than that, Your Honor.
Well, if Rankin negotiated with Kleberg to sell it, with Rankin knowing he didn't have permission to sell the property, but the money is paid to the estate in the sale of the property, and the estate takes the money, is that, do you not have to show that didn't happen, to show that there was an extrinsic fraud in the transaction?
No. The reason why is because the estate didn't own the money, didn't own the property, didn't have the right to sell the property. The owners of the vested remainder interest owned that property. And
But weren't they the heirs of the estate, or they had direct ownership of the property?
Helen's will was probated in Richland County, South Carolina, and in Nueces County. When she died, that title transferred eo instante to her grandchildren in trust, invested remainder. And they own the property, and under Article 1202, they have the right to sell that property or to do whatever they want to with that property. That's what this statute is all about, because the problem in the late 1800s, and it's still a good public policy today because the laws are still on the books, was to prevent collusive plundering of these estates. When people die, the testator's wills were completely disregarded, and the property would be gone. And that was sound public policy back then to protect that interest, and it's still sound public policy today. And even if money did change hands, which we dispute, it wouldn't alter the fact that it did not go to the heirs, to the remainder men. They are the owners. And under Helen's will, they were entitled to take that property, invested remainder, in trust. Now, the adequacy or the inadequacy of the consideration, Your Honor, in my opinion, masks the evidence. The no evidence challenge of extrinsic fraud is defeated in this case because we have joint illegal conduct between King and Kleberg, and the purpose of this joint illegal conduct was to negate the rights of the owners of the vested remainder interest. So under a civil conspiracy analysis, we've got an illegal purpose, we've got illegal means, which was making misrepresentations to the judge to get the settlement, we've got violations of Article 1934, which required the probate court to approve. That was violated right there. That's an illegal act. It's an illegal act. We've got a violation of Article 1202. That's another illegal act. We've got a violation of the United States Constitution, keeping people who are parties, who must be parties, and concealing their property rights in an illegal judgment, which is what that's exactly what they did.
Two questions. Can you answer why the discovery rule applies to a bill of review proceeding first? And then second, even assuming it does, how is the harm that you're alleging here, how is it inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable? And on the discoverability, we're talking about public records and documents that were in the account book and the heir's possession for years. So
correct.
How is the bill of review proceeding? How does the discovery rule apply?
The discovery rule applies. This court has held since the 1800s, consistently, fraud, discovery rule, fiduciaries breaching duties, discovery rule. Slavey Burnett Trust, Port Arthur Milling Company, Willis v. Manford. Negligence, not even a fraud case when there's an attorney involved. And Clayburgh is their attorney, he's our attorney. And so just looking at the prior common law as we know it, we've got that here. Okay, and there's no deviation from those lines of cases under those circumstances. So if you apply the categorical approach, you answer the question 150 years ago. If, as the defendants have suggested, that the court ought to make a new category for bills of review, okay, then we have extrinsic fraud, which is fraud. And my argument is, we've already figured out that fraud has a discovery rule, so how can extrinsic fraud not? And what policy interest would be furthered by saying, well, extrinsic fraud, no discovery rule? The discovery rule is part and parcel, an essential part of this court's jurisprudence to suppress fraud. And if you take that away, you're going to increase the number of fraudulently procured judgments. And there's no policy interest in having a fraudulently procured judgment in Texas. If you look at the Restatement of Judgments, Section 70, the commentary talks about what the policy interests are in a fraudulently procured judgment. And it's zero. Zero. There is none. We don't want it. We can't have it. When we find it, we've got to stop it. Anything else invites a lot of problems that this court doesn't need. We do not need lawyers colluding with opposing parties and confessing fraudulent judgments out against people who have property rights. But I would say there's one exception to that rule. It's very important in this case. In the Hazel Atlas case from the Supreme Court of the United States, they noted that if there is a bona fide purchaser under the judgment, that's an exception. We sued non-bona fide purchasers. A court of equity is capable of fashioning a judgment, in this case, that properly balances the party's rights. Because there are not bona fide purchasers, there are direct donee beneficiaries of extrinsic fraud feasors, and under this unique circumstance, a court of equity can fashion a decree that will not offend vested property rights in bona fide purchasers. And as this court noted in Eaton v. Husted, this is not an issue that's free from difficulty. As the court's opinion closed on this issue, the court said, here we are. That case involved the rights of a true owner versus the rights of a person who defrauded a trust, a successor of a person who defrauded a trust. And the court looked at the balance and said, you know, my time apparently is expired.
Mr. Smith, I want to ask you one question. Mr. Hatchell alluded to the fact that we have a strong presumption of regular, that judgments are proper, regular, the proceedings and so forth. And you talked about policies. Is there not a policy that would, as to finality, so that in this day and time with the computer records, the thing we're able to search by computers, that this would open up a whole new door. People going through fast judgments for the last, whenever they first started doing judgments, and finding some irregularity that couldn't be raised somewhere along the line.
I very carefully considered that issue, and I asked myself the question. Looking at the probate records of cause number 363 in Helens Estate, they show three events right up to the time before this judgment. Okay? And I said, well, how do we know what happened after that? And the answer is, we do know that there was not an order approving this particular sale. Because Jim Wells' title opinion in December 2nd says he has carefully examined these documents, including the probate proceedings. And I think I can show that to you.
Okay.
Okay. Jim Wells' title opinion, I can get the court the citation to it, says he's carefully examined all of these documents, and he lists the documents, the judgment cause number 1279, Helen's probate proceeding, and he and Claybrook has personal knowledge, who's there, and Jim Wells, King's lawyer and Claybrook's lawyer, he must have had personal knowledge, and he does not recite that there is an order authorizing the sale. But with respect to the estate of Hamilton B., there is a complete recitation of how they presented. That's the Lewis estate where King and Chapman took the deed jointly from the administrator. There's a recitation that there's an order signed by the judge, that they presented a motion to the probate court, that the deed was approved. These people knew their procedure, and if that had happened, that's where they would have said it. But the records are complete, and they do show this. There was no order, and this will not cause a problem in Texas land titles, because what we have essentially is a unique circumstance where there are no bona fide purchasers in the chain.
So your answer is this is a unique circumstance?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Please, the court. I have three specific comments in relation to questions from the court and one general observation. Questions by Mr. Justice Wainwright and Mr. Justice Enoch. Mr. Justice Wainwright, the probate proceedings are not an issue in this case. It's the 1883 judgment that's an issue. Presumption of regularity of probate proceedings, I think, is secure under this court's decision in Baker versus Coe, but my able co-counsel reminds me that it's the regularity of the 1883 judgment on its face that's the real legal issue in the case. And that judgment is clearly regular on its face because the executor, Mr. Rankin, clearly had authority under Article 1202, which has been shown you this morning, to bring the action. And Mr. Justice Enoch, under the will of Helen Chapman, Executor Rankin had specific authority to sell property. So the recitations of sale in the deed, I think, show that the judgment is regular on its face and in conformity with all laws and governing instruments. Mr. Justice Jefferson, regarding the application of the discovery rule in this case, I think it is not a wise choice for this court to say that because there may be an embedded element within the cause of action, which could be established by fraud, doesn't have to be, that suddenly it's a fraud action to which the discovery rule applies. This court did not hold, for example, in Walmart versus Sturgis, that because you could prove the independently tortious conduct sufficient to justify prospective interference, that suddenly tortious interference cases were fraud cases, to which now the four-year statute applies and the discovery applies. So I think that counsel, as well intentioned as the argument is off base in the argument. The broad observation that I would make is that I don't think it is lost on this court what's really at stake in this case. In Baker versus Coe, this court quoted Louisiana Supreme Court as making an observation which I suspect is true, and that is that the majority of land titles, which certainly was true in Louisiana in the 1800s, and I suspect is true in Texas, are dependent upon probate proceedings and judgments. If judgments that have established title can be attacked 112 years later on the basis of the type of suspicion and innuendo that's involved in this case, no titles per se. Here's what the fraud is: not that Claybrook represented King in other matters. The fraud has to be that of King. King had to corrupt Attorney Claybrook, who in turn had to corrupt Rankin, and somehow or another fraudulently enter into the judgment, which would not otherwise have entered into. That the only basis for this fraud, really, is number one, documents that they knew existed and had been in the Chapman's possession for 100 years, and a newspaper article reporting a conclusion by a King Ranch archivist over 100 years. That archivist not even having been born, and yet he is giving opinions upon what the intentions of Mr. Clayburgh were, which don't even establish the fraud necessary. So I think that this is a case which is too wispy in its nature, and which stands against too many legal principles to be affirmed, and we request that it be reversed and the summary judgment reinstated.
Thank you. Counsel, that concludes the argument of the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
All rise.